Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's a Sunday. It's 10 p.m. here in lovely Skopje, Macedonia, and we are streaming live to the Countercurrents DLive and Odyssey channels. And tonight we're having on a first-time guest on the Writer's Block. It's Marco from Zentropa. Marco, how are you doing tonight?
Thank you for the introduction. I'm very well. Just came back from a kind of a lengthy few day trip. I was in Bosnia, actually visiting not mine, but my girlfriend's relatives. We went to a family tradition called Slava. You know about it, of course. So yeah, it was a really nice and fun few days.
Indeed, that's always interesting. For those who don't know, some of the peoples in the Balkans have this tradition of having a family saint, and when it's that saint's feast day, we have this Slava, which just means celebration or feast, to honor the saint and to honor our family. And it's very nice. I always have fun. My family saint is Saint Dimitri of Salonika. So, you know, that's in November, though. And we're going to be discussing the situation in Serbia tonight. We are going to be discussing the Kosovo crisis. We're going to be discussing the predicament of white people in Serbia, because wherever there are white people, there are predicaments, there's problems, there's trouble. It seems to be a racist destiny in this cursed age. But before we do that, let me just let our audience know all the ways in which they can communicate with us and donate. Now, first of all, you should donate to us through Entropy. Now, the Countercurrents fundraiser is over, but that does not mean we're going to say no to money. So if you want to ask me questions, if you want to ask Marco questions, you can go over to entropystream.live/countercurrents. It's going to say we're not streaming. That's because we're not streaming on Entropy. We're streaming on DLive and Odyssey. But you can still send offline questions and offline donations. Or if you just want to donate, just want to give out of the goodness of your heart, that's been known to happen sometimes. Yeah, you can do that. And of course, there is also Cash App. Now, Cash App, they take a lesser percentage of your donation than Entropy. They take 5% as opposed to 15%. However, you cannot ask me questions on Cash App. I'm not going to be able to see the donations. So again, if you just want to give, Cash App is the way to go. Now, we're also taking donations over on DLive and Odyssey. And we take all the lemons and ice creams and diamonds and ninjaginis and all, even the elusive ninja over on DLive. And with donations of diamond and above, that's 100 lemons and above, you can also ask questions and post comments over on DLive. And also on Odyssey, you can send us a cash tip in American dollars for the time being, or Library Coin, which is Odyssey's very own cryptocurrency, the Library Foundation's cryptocurrency. Now, I don't think they're that convertible to dollars. I mean, they're convertible to dollars, but the exchange rate is kind of shit. However, we do need them to keep content, video and audio, up on Odyssey, because Odyssey is pay-to-play. So even the Library Coin is appreciated. You can actually earn those for free for watching Odyssey videos. So none of you have an excuse for not donating at least Library Coin over on Odyssey. And with that, I believe we have exhausted all of the direct ways in which you can contribute to the show and to the broader Countercurrents organization. However, you can contribute indirectly by purchasing the fine products of our sponsor, Aljaska Chaga. Oh, that's hot. But it is refreshing. It is delicious, and it's got antioxidants. It's going to keep you it keeps me energized. It also helps with my bowel motions, and we, as you get older, those become more and more a chore. And of course, Chaga doesn't only sell tea. He also sells soap. Every time, before I do this show, I pop into the shower just so I can look the best for my audience. And what do you know? Because they got the little Chaga chunks and bits of coal up in the Chaga soap, you get a good deep scrub. Get rid of that excess dead skin, the, what do you call that, the above the epidermis. I forget. I used to know this, but I do believe that's all of the crass financial concerns for tonight. So without further ado, I want to let our guest introduce himself. Marco, this is your first time on the Writer's Block. So imagine there's people in the audience who've never heard of you, and let them know who you are and what you are about.
Well, the shortest I could describe myself is I'm a young Serbian nationalist. Started with activism, radical nationalist activism, about 10 years ago when I was still in high school. And then, you know, and progressed on and on. It was, you know, a couple of organizations I went through. And basically the road of my nationalist activism led me to a community called Zentropa. And eventually we founded our own club, which is basically a place you can have a beer, read a book, drink coffee, talk with friends. And also we host charity nights, different conferences about different topics, movie nights and so on. But yeah, I'm basically, well, my life currently rotates around that, my job, and well, I'm finishing uni at the same time. But there's not much to say above that. Also, yeah, we have a magazine and I'm editing it. It's a really good thing. For those who don't know about Zentropa, it's an international nationalist community. However, paradoxical that might sound, it is international because we have chapters in France, in Serbia, Russia, Ukraine, Argentina, Greece, and Germany. There used to be other ones, but these are the ones that are currently active. And it's not an organization that people are used to in the sense that it has a kind of a strict hierarchical structure that, like, you have, you know, a president of your organization, meetings. It's a proper community, you know. It's literally a group of friends doing activism and having fun above else. But the thing is, the whole idea of Zentropa is to guide people. If you search for the word itself, you'll stumble upon a movie called Zentropa. And that's how actually the group got its name. This year is going to be 20 years since the community has been founded in Quebec, actually, by French nationalists who are living there now. These people live in all over Europe and the world. There was actually a chapter in Asia of European expatriates living in China called, the blog was called ONG, but it was called, yeah, I think, Zentropa East Asia. And in general, the community tries to bring new aesthetics. It tries to bring out new philosophies. And in general, the nationalist movement nowadays, I remember when I was younger, that wasn't so long ago, but it was much more active, much more diverse. And we're not trying to bring back the old or renew, but we're trying to do as it should have been always, the nationalist movement as it is. It's a revolutionary movement. We've always been trying to bring new aesthetics, talk about new topics, advise people and guide them in general.
That's all very interesting. Now, of course, you know, people might find that a little paradoxical, international nationalism. However, one thing I've realized is that all of our nations are under threat of erasure, of destruction by our enemies. So since we are under attack by a common foe, under one attack by a common foe, we should be cooperating anyway. So kudos to you, kudos to Zentropa, and to everything that you do, even if it is, you know, just a social club. In many ways, we need that. Young people have no guidance these days, especially young nationalists. They don't know who to look up to. That is always sorely needed in this movement. However, I called you on this show. I invited you on this show because you and I, we were talking privately, and you pointed out to me that I have some misconceptions about the Serbian state. I assumed that it's still basically chugging along an old ideological steam from the Yugoslav period. And we have discussed Yugoslavia here on this show in the past with Dr. Tomislav Sunic, about how it was an ideological communist state which sought to essentially erase all of its constituent nationalities systematically. But your position is, and I'm open to being persuaded, that the current Serbian state, at the very least, and you know, maybe the other successor states of Yugoslavia, they're not really ideological anymore. Would you mind explaining your position?
Well, a lot of people nowadays see the whole political scene of Europe, and we're not talking just about the European Union. We're talking like everything from Lisbon to Moscow, and we see different ideologies there, even though it's not like it's the 19th century or early 20th where you have political parties which openly in their name state their ideologies. Though some of the older parties, for example, like the Christian Social Christian Union or Christian Social Union of Germany, these are like the old names, right? But if you take a look, the new parties of Europe have these more like marketing slogans. It's more like a brand name than it is like an ideological. Take a look at the Alternative for Germany or the Greens or Pirate Party. It doesn't say conservative anymore. It doesn't say left-wing, communist, whatever. In Serbia, we have a different situation. I think it's more like a situation in almost every Eastern European post-communist state that most political parties have don't really have ideologies and just go along with what pays the best. In the Serbian, I might like, I also would agree of salt because I'm not really familiar with, for example, the political situation in Czech Republic or Slovakia, but for Serbia, I can say for sure that most political parties don't have ideologies in the sense that they don't strictly follow one. They follow whichever brings them the most votes and whichever keeps them in power. Nowadays, the party that is in power is the Serbian Progressive Party. Now, already in the name, you see the word progressive. They claim to be the inheritors of the ideology of the old Serbian Progressive Party from the 19th century, which was everything but progressive in the modern day sense. They were like kind of conservative liberals, conservative market liberals in the 19th century sense, of course. These people, no, they don't have an ideology. It's a proper catch-all party. They won the power. They won their first major elections in 2012 on a platform of kind of a conservative, you know, conservative Serbian patriotism, a bit of liberal economics. But for example, in one of the in the early party political program, which was of course deleted from their website afterwards, actually a few years it took them a few years to realize it was still there. Was it said officially that the goal of the Serbian Progressive Party is that the unification between Serbia and Republic of Srpska, the reconciliation, liberation of Kosovo, and I think Montenegro was also mentioned somewhere in there. The truth, well, how they do things actually, it's far from that. The people who founded the party were ex-members of the Serbian Radical Party, which was known as the Serbian Ultranationalist Party. I would describe them as more Jacobinistic, you know, nationalist, but like with this French Republican ideas, well, French revolutionary ideas, with its leader Vojislav Šešelj. And if you dwell deeper in, you will understand that it is proper, pure Jacobinism. On the other hand, you have the Serbian progressives who wanted to gain power because the Serbian radicals never were in power, even though they were the strongest party in Serbia. They didn't want to get into power by coalitions. They wanted to rule alone. And now Vučić, the current prime minister, and the clique around him had enough of that. And these people founded their own party. Now they're in power. And slowly over time, from 2012, and now we're entering the 12th year of their rule. These people have slowly but surely tightened their grip over Serbia. Previously, they had to go into coalitions, but nowadays they have only one party in their grand coalition, which is the Socialist Party of Serbia. And they have absolutely nobody to challenge their authority. When they go to elections, the Serbian Progressive Party alone has like something like, I don't know, 50% of votes, which is, you know, tremendous. It is also to be noted that it is the largest political party in Europe by membership. I wouldn't take in Russia with that because I think the United Russia is even bigger. But you could say if we take out Russia out of the equation, the Serbian Progressive Party is the largest one with about 750,000 members. So these people, for example,
Vučić, how much is that as a percentage of population?
Well, we had our most recent population census in last year. I think it was something like September, October, and the results just came in. And the thing is, we now are around 6.8 million people. So that will be, I don't know, like something like 15 to 20%, I think.
Yeah, those are communist party levels.
Exactly. And as I
because I recently saw a graphic of membership of communist parties as percentage of population in the Warsaw Pact, and all of them were above 8% of the population, which is huge for a political party, right?
The thing is, like, these people really rule like communists. Like, to get a job, Serbia, like most post-communist countries, has still a lot of state-owned enterprises, some of which I support. Like, big mines should be owned by the state, big industries, you know, so you don't allow foreign monopoly or private plutocratic monopoly. But the thing is, to get a job in such companies, or even to get a job, let's say, as a teacher in high school or primary school, you have to be a member of the party. So it is proper Bolshevism. It's Bolshevism at its finest. And not in the sense like, yeah, they're saying long live the world revolution, but in the practical sense, they do things like Bolsheviks.
Leninism. Leninism in its organizational form.
Yeah, yeah. In the organizational sense, yeah, they're proper commies. There's no doubt in that. They inherited a lot of people. And even if you look at a political scene, almost all the people, we're not talking about the younger generation politicians, but almost all of the older guard, we're talking about politicians who overthrew the Milosevic regime, are ex-communists. So nothing really did change here. We had our anti-communist revolution in the year of 2000. On the 5th of October, we toppled the Milosevic regime, but nothing really changed. His party is still in power. They're in coalition with Vučić. Though it's interesting to note, and when we talk about them, that Milosevic himself from The Hague said that they turned rogue and they don't follow his policies anymore. But that's a different topic. To talk about the current situation in Serbia, yes, basically every party will do whatever they can to secure the vote. So Vučić, for example, sometimes he holds fiery nationalistic speeches, for example, in regard to Kosovo or Republic of Srpska. And some people might get an impression that he's just continuing the old road from the Serbian Radical Party, but he just put it into like a nice facade of progressivism. While on the other hand, you have proper colonial policies. Serbia, in the economical sense, is a Western colony. There's no doubt in that. Our economy is not independent. It depends on both the West and the East for, if you look at our trade, where the biggest trade is like with the EU. But for example, we are really reliant on Russia for stuff like gas and oil. We sold most of our national resources to foreigners, Chinese companies like Rio Tinto, who literally destroy nature just to dig out minerals, for example, lithium. They wanted to do that in Serbia, and there were massive protests against that. And these people are ruthless in regards to, you know, nature. We sold our oil industry to Russians now because of the situation. Russians are going to resell it back to us, and we're going to sell it again to Azerbaijan. Then our car industry, which was, well, you know yourself about Zastava, it's destroyed. It doesn't exist anymore.
They shut it down?
Yeah, they sold it to the Italians, then the Italians shut it down.
Okay.
and that's the story of Serbia. We had like massive privatizations. Now, for example, in Belgrade, they're building like these massive buildings, and everybody's asking, who the hell is buying them, but it's actually like a major scheme for money laundering. They're now even trying to sell our own electrical industry company, the Electro Industry of Serbia, which is like one of the biggest electric industry companies in this part of Europe. And like, it's actually doing good. We're exporting electricity, but they want to sell it because apparently it's not doing good. They sold one of our biggest banks called the Commercial Bank to some Westerners. We're even losing that. They want to sell the post office. They want to sell the railroad companies. And basically, yeah, we're a proper colony. About nationalism, more or less nationalists are being prosecuted as much in the West. The spine of nationalists in Serbia has been broken by the regime. And yeah, you can be a nationalist. We have our own small club. We, you know, have fun in it. But it's if you try to tip the scale, if you get massive numbers, if you start gaining like a lot of attention, if people start flocking to you, you're going to get shut down very quickly. One of the biggest, like, we're not talking about regime-oriented nationalists. We're talking about proper radical, anti-liberal, anti-system nationalists. The Obraz movement, which at its peak had around 100,000 members. Its leader, he was killed. He died, actually. Officially, he died in a car crash, but like his body was found next to his car in some ditch, beaten up, you know. And that's how it goes here. Basically, here the state is... It's like whoever read Thomas Hobbes know what I'm talking about when I talk about the Leviathan, and that is what the state is here. And I believe the situation is more or less the same in other parts of Europe, except here it's not hidden. You see, in the West, you have this kind of facade of nice, you know, freedom, democracy, and so on. Here, no, they don't hide anything. Like, you don't really have to dig deep to see how corrupt and how authoritarian it is. We have gay parades. Actually, Belgrade was the host of last year's Euro Pride, which didn't really go well because there were massive religious protests against it. But still, it went through. The Prime Minister of Serbia is lesbian, and she's open about that. The government supports LGBT organizations. They regularly also support, you know, liberal organizations hosting, you know, various talks about, you know, freedom and stuff like that. Also, they're supporting these new gender equality laws. Serbia also, in its health system, has, I don't know why or how this thing started, but our government provides free money for people who want to get sex change. So a lot of Westerners actually flock to Serbia to get their wieners cut off. And yeah, it is serious. No, you have to take everything differently because Serbia as the state, the Republic of Serbia as a political entity, it's not the real representative of what Serbs are. Same as the city of Belgrade, which is more or less like every capital, a Babylon of sorts. It's not what Serbs are. Now, people would ask themselves, if Serbs are so traditional, which they are, the average folk, you know, the average Serb is a traditionalist. He's a nationalist. He's a conservative. Why don't they rise up? Because if they
why doesn't anyone rise up, really? I mean,
same
people,
thing.
I have both Archie and Carlota in chat are asking, why did the Serbs accept an LGBT prime minister? You know, she's a lesbian, she dresses as a man and openly leads a homosexual lifestyle. Why did the Americans accept the election fraud and Joe Biden or a black president? Why do Germans accept the things they accept? Why do we in Macedonia accept the bullshit we accept? Because we are under occupation. The entire white race is under occupation. And
if you try to rise up and you gather a lot of people, you're going to get shut down. And here, like the media, we have private owned media and state owned media, like some televisions, which are state owned, but they're like private owned media, which are owned by the government in the sense that these people, like these media moguls, like super rich people, they're mostly pro-government, and other media outlets, which are kind of opposition, so to say, they're not opposition, they're Western controlled opposition. They don't talk about that. They don't give one damn if she's gay or not. And another funny thing, it's like even salute that and talk about that openly. Like, yeah, it's great. Like, she's gay, you know, and all, we're progressive. But the average Serb doesn't watch that. Those televisions, they watch the garbage, which is like pushed state-owned, private-owned media, which are pro-government. They are basically, you know, they have nationalist rants, and people sometimes really believe that Vucic is actually doing a good thing. If you would like only watch what they're saying in the media, you would believe that he's a proper radical right-wing nationalist. And that's like the average, like, let's say you're a farmer. Most of the day, you don't have time to read like political articles. You don't have time to read, you know, massive posts or analyses. You read what's like, you know, the shortest. You buy the cheapest newspaper just to get informed. You're not interested in the political debate. You have to work on your farm. You have to feed your children. And it's really hard to live in these circumstances where we are poor. Our industries have been taken from us. Taxes are super high. We have some of the most, like, it's insane. Like, Serbia has the highest gas prices in Europe. And we should be having some of the lowest ones because we get it cheap from the Russians, but we have high gas taxes. So,
it's something I noticed when I was driving through Serbia some time ago, that basically gas was much more expensive there than it was in Macedonia and in other places I went. Just, I had no idea. I couldn't explain it to myself. I thought they were good with the Russians, right? They should have cheap gas, but it's unbelievable.
To put
it's
it
just
into
from the taxes.
To put it into perspective, Serbia, like, for 100 liters of gas, you would need 20% of a medial Serbian salary. So for 100 liters of normal gas, you would need 20% of your salary. And that's like the highest in Europe. The highest in Europe. For example, Norway has much more expensive gas prices, like per liter. Like, I don't know. That's what the media does here. So they would show you a map, say, oh, Serbia has the gas prices in Serbia are like 1.60 euro per liter. And in Norway, it's like 2.16. But if you look differently, in Norway, for 100 liters of gas, you just need 3.1% of your salary, whereas in Serbia, actually, the actual number is 22.7%. So that tells you, like, it, around us, like, even Bosnia is like 14.4, Bulgaria 13.2, Romania 11.7. And if you look at the West, where apparently they have high gas prices, it's like 5.3% of your salary, and so on and so on.
Right. And so this is essentially the state making money on people just buying gasoline for their vehicles.
Ooh, not even that. On tobacco, we have, for example, in Serbia, we call it PDV. It's like the tax. When you buy stuff in the shop, you have tax.
Value-added tax, right?
Exactly. Value-added tax. You have value-added tax. In Serbia, it's 20%. 20% value-added tax. Everything is super
expensive. In
Macedonia,
it's 18% on Class A goods, 5% of on Class B goods.
We don't have that.
No scaling like that?
No, there is no scale. So you want to buy a coffee? Yeah, fine, it's 20%. You want to buy a banana? It's 20%.
In Macedonia, if you're buying basic foodstuffs, it's 5%, right? Because it's on non-basic items of which you get 18% value-added tax. I mean, it's higher in other places. I remember, I think it was 22% in Croatia last time I was. And the waiter there said that, you know, PDV, it stands for Pola Dajem Vladi, which means I give back to the government, right, in Croatian and Serbian.
I might sound like a libertarian, but, like, really here, taxation is theft, like proper theft. And nobody knows, like, where that money ends up. Another interesting thing is, like, there's this, the Belgrade public transport company has around 5,000 employees. And I'm like, how, like, we don't even have that many buses in Belgrade. Belgrade is a big city. It's the biggest city in ex-Yugoslavia, out of all ex-Yugoslav republics. But still, you don't need 5,000 employees. Maybe you'd need that in Athens. I don't know. And it's always in minus. They never make a profit. So how do they do that? You have this other company called Belgrade. It's called the Belgrade Electric Company. But what they do is actually they supply heating. And this company is actually a well-functioning company because, it's well-organized and stuff. So what they do is they increased the prices of heating, and then they, from that company, they take money and funnel it into the public transport company, so it seems that it's not losing money. And why does the public transport company have 5,000 employees? Well, members of the party have to work somewhere, So that's what they do. They fictively, they make fake jobs for party members.
Yeah, that's the old solution from the communist period.
Exactly.
We had one of the biggest woes in the 90s and even early 2000s in the post-communist space was really, we called them, I don't know if there's a word in English for it, but there was a bunch of people who were fired from state-owned enterprises, and even from state-owned enterprises which were privatized but turned out to be profitable. But it turns out that there was a lot of fat, that there were a lot of people employed for whom there was no economic justification for employing them. And in the post-communist period, many people were employed, as you said, through patronage networks of the ruling parties, right?
Yeah.
And this is not something, what's amazing to me is that you're telling me all of these stories, and I know them very well because we have the same thing going on in Macedonia. And recently I've been studying about the political and economic history of Greece, and they've been doing it since the 70s, since the Papandreou period. It's amazing. But what's very interesting to me is that all of this is done. The Serbian Progressive Party, the Srpska Radikalna Stranka, which is...
Srpska Napredna.
Oh, yes. Sorry. Yeah, Radikalna is Serbian Radical Party. That's Šešin's party. But Aleksandar Vučić's party, the party of Vučić and Brnabić and all these people, they claim to be progressive, but to nationalists, they pretend to be nationalists. To liberals, they pretend to be liberals. To libertarians, they pretend to be libertarians. To, leftoid, to communists, they pretend to be communists.
I mean, they have like a proper person.
But there is no ideology behind it. Huh?
They have like, for each of these like groups, they have a representative. Vučić is like the... literally like the all father, the greatest son of our nation. Like in Yugoslavia, it was like the najbolji sin naših naroda, the greatest son of our peoples. Here is like basically the greatest son of our people. And literally he has a proper cult of personality. And then you have this gay lesbian prime minister, and she's like for the gay liberal public. Then you have this woman called Zorana Mihajlović, who is like, she's a monster. Like she's the proper, like she doesn't even hide it. She's a representative of Western economic interests. You have this person called Aleksandar Vulin. He was a member of this party called YUL, the Yugoslav United Left, which was a satellite party of the Milosevic regime. He was the general secretary of that party. We call it a van party, like those vans, like for like 10 people. We call it a van party because it has like a few members. They are in parliament, but they're technically the Serbian Progressive Party. It's called their movement is called the Movement of Socialists. And this guy is like has a picture of a chair in his room. He's a Marxist, So for every single ideology on the spectrum, they have a face. They have somebody to talk about it. So it's a proper big tent catch-all party, which is basically just the colonial governorate of Serbia. It's nothing else than that. Whoever like nowadays stumbles upon Serbia, they will use it in whichever way they want. And the Serbian people are, because of the wars, because of what happened here, and we were put on the same process the Germans were put after World War II. If you could compare the Hague trials with the Nuremberg trials, you could also compare it to the policies that the West is trying to put on us. For example, the collective blame for everything that happened in World War II. They're doing that in Serbia. They're trying to put, like, they're teaching kids in schools. They're trying to do that. They're trying to infiltrate our school system, and I'm afraid they're already really good at it. And they're trying to teach kids, we're all war criminals. We should apologize and stuff like that. It's really like, you know, people who know history and people who are interested in it know and like saw it coming and see it coming. It's in the process. But if it continues like this for the next 10 years, we will end up like the Germans. We will end up spineless. Still, people here are very patriotic, very fierce. They don't like the West. They don't like Western degeneracy. But it's our generation. And the generations from the future, they won't give a damn about it. They will want to be the West. They will accept it. And they will not even accept the West, but they will start apologizing right, like the rest of the whites do, because they're being brainwashed in schools. And it's all over, in my opinion, for every Western country. And that's how it started. The left didn't. It's what this Italian communist talked about, the long Gramsci, Antonio Gramsci was his name, the long march through institutions. It's what the left did. They understood the European communists who were not in the USSR. They understood they can't do revolution, so they switched to universities and high schools. And sooner or later, they started educating young communists, well, young people who became communists because of them. And then you have this what's going on in the West. They first take over your education system, and then it's over. Then it's over. You have to literally, and in my opinion, to fight them, the West, or the West as a civilizational concept of modern liberalism, I'm an advocate of European civilization, not a Western one, because the West itself for me represents, you know, LGBT fake stuff and so on. We can't take on the state, right? Because it's too powerful. It's not the Weimar Republic, which was really like, you had brawls in the streets every day. You can't do that nowadays. You have cameras and everything. The way for nationalists in Serbia and abroad in other European countries and other white countries is through institutions. Not to be a part of the system, but like take over the educational institutions like the left did. That's how they won. And we need to start educating our own generations so that we save what can be saved. I mean, I understand
that masculine urge to take matters into your own hands and solve problems the way they ought to be solved, like our grandparents used to solve them. But at this time, this is just counterproductive. I say to people, you know, the time will come for these direct measures, for these direct solutions. We will take them from a position of power, from the position of the state. We will do it legally, and everyone will be happy, and everything will fall into place. But for the time being, our job is to create culture, to create education, to essentially work out an ideology which will, at some point in the future, form the basis for a takeover of power.
I agree with that, and to take things legally in the system won't allow you to win elections. Take a look what happened to Golden Dawn, for example. That's a very good example of what they do. And then you have parties which get infiltrated from within, or their leaders get corrupted and like, you know, bought by money, like Marine Le Pen in France. They're essentially doing nothing. Like, well, now she's been kicked out of her, well, she's not in charge of Front National, or now it's what's it called, the National Renewal, Rénovation Nationale, whatever. No, the National Review, the National Assembly. So, I mean, it's these people are not doing anything. They're just like, you know, getting, you know, right-wingers under control. The system won't allow you to win elections. If you start gaining numbers, they will arrest you and like make up some scandal, or like put rifles in your home and say, yeah, you're gun running and organizing a terrorist takeover, whatever. The system nowadays is too strong, and we're already there in 1984. We're already in Orwellian times and living them. And you see what's going on in China, and that's really coming here very fast. We don't see it. Like, one day, you know yourself, like 10, 15 years ago, we didn't have smartphones, none of this Facebook and internet stuff. Nobody was taking your not even address, but like what you're talking over the phone. Like, the companies weren't like putting commercials in your face based on what you're searching on the internet, or what you were talking on your phone, or what you sent to your best friend last night. Now you live that. And if private companies have that, God knows what states have in their arsenal of, you know, control. And it's the same with this last COVID, I like to call it scamdemic. it's like you see how people are easily bent and fooled. And now, when everybody sees us, it's like, suddenly it's gone. You know, apparently the deadliest disease since the Black Plague, it's gone. It's gone. Now they're trying to say, well, let's like forget about what happened. Like they're literally putting muzzles on people. And that's how people easily are bent. And here in Serbia, it was no different. People were really afraid of what was going on. It was a mass hysteria here, as well as it was in France and other countries. Yes, we had massive riots because at some point people were fed up with it, but you know, quicker than in other countries, but still some people bought it, the whole thing. So Serbia isn't really different from any other Western country, except that we resisted Western influence for so long. And I think that's thanks to the NATO bombing, because of the average Serb, he doesn't hate. There is not a word in the English dictionary to describe what are the feelings of an average Serb towards the United States of America and everything that comes from there. Any kind of culture, any kind of, well, I wouldn't even call it culture, what's coming from there, but whatever. Every new thing, people reject it. Even some things which are like kind of, let's say, good when they're little, they reject it. No, it's Western, it's US, it's disgusting. But slowly that mentality is going, it's fading away slowly. It's not really a quick rate, but like in the next 30 years, like maybe even more, but it will fade away. You know, basically, yes, we got bombarded for 78 days and nights, but it made us hate the degeneracy. It made us hate what comes from the U.S. and what they make, what the system in the U.S. makes. And, you know, people here hate Soros and everything, and they, you know, try to reject any kind of degeneracy. But when you're put into a position where you can't work without being a party member or voting for a party, where you can't voice your opinion or you will lose your job, you ought to bow down, because they control you in whichever way they can. And here it's like a mix of, you know, pornographic totalitarianism and, you know, Bolshevik totalitarianism. You know, pornographic totalitarianism, they keep you in check by showing you porn and Netflix. And this, in the Soviet Union, they have, you know, Bolshevik totalitarianism, where they put a gun to your forehead and say you have to be a communist.
It's I wrote an article. It was, I forget whether it was last year or earlier this year, but it's called Western Promises. All right. And it's really about, some people ask me, okay, why do you have so many Eastern Europeans from post-communist states? They're trying to not only migrate to the West, but they're trying to absorb Western culture, because people see them and I see them. And I was one of these people, right? I am in many ways more Western than Balkanoid due to my education, due to actively trying to rise above my birth. And the reason is because our societies are fundamentally sick. And I say to people, societies in the Balkans are so fundamentally sick that even the West, even as it is today, degenerate and gay and multicultural, and you go to America and it's legal for black people to rape your wife or girlfriend, and it's illegal for you to defend her or to defend yourself from black violence, even with all of those problems, the West is better in some respects. You can find a job without humiliating yourself, without joining these patronage networks. You can essentially attain a measure of respect and freedom in the West, which is just not available in the East. And we really live in mafia states. Like you mentioned, the money laundering problem in Belgrade. We have the same problem in Skopje, literally the same. All of the narco capital of Europe that the Albanian mafia makes, they launder it here. And it's really distorting the real estate market to the point where people just cannot buy houses anymore.
Here it's like the average, take that with a grain of salt, but like I think in Belgrade, the capital of Serbia, the average price per square meter for a new apartment would be like, I don't know, 5,000 to 6,000 euros. Imagine that with a salary, and the average salary in Serbia is about 700 euros, which I highly doubt. But that's what the government says, apparently. But even that's with insane. That salary, how the hell does somebody buy an apartment like, let's say a 30 square meter apartment, you're a young man, you want to move in with your girlfriend. How the hell do you buy an apartment with that money?
That is insane.
You don't. In this part of Belgrade that they're building up, which is literally built on drug money and God knows whatever, God knows what else. And I mean, it's not even drug money. It's also they steal money from the, you know, from this, you know, the state itself. So they have to launder it somehow. And there, it's in some apartments go like the price per square meter goes as high as 9,000 euros.
You think you're buying in New York or something, but no.
Exactly. It's like, what the hell is going on?
We have questions from the audience. We have ABC for 10 American dollars over on Entropy. And he asks, Serbia is supposed to join the EU in 2025, but does not want to join NATO. What is the stand of the Serbian far right on both these issues? Can Serbia be successfully in the EU and in the Russian military sphere of influence at the same time? Are you familiar with what the EU did in other Balkan countries? Well, I think this may be a good time to segue into the second question I wanted to ask you. You know, what is Serbia's geopolitical positioning, or specifically the posturing of the Serbian Progressive Party, of Aleksandar Vučić, of all of these people, not only vis-a-vis Russia, because a lot of people assume, oh, Serbia is always with Russia, and a lot of Serbs I speak to, is they say, oh, we are always with Russia, but in practice we see something else. And I also want to ask about Chinese influence in Serbia. You mentioned that the Chinese are trying to mine lithium and destroy the countryside. Or would you mind explaining that?
So, well, let's first start from this phrase, well, word, coin word, which rings in my ears always, the far right. I refrain from calling the nationalist movements far right, because it's a term made by the liberal left in order to, well, not even the liberal left, the far left, to basically turn us into some maniacal radicals. But if you take, I mean, even the spectrum says it, the far right is actually like ultra capitalism. I would say, like, I just call it the radical right. I consider myself like something the Italians made up, estrema centro alto, which means extreme high center, which was made up as a joke, but really makes a lot of sense if you take a look at the spectrum. But the main thing is, like, the Serbian radical right is both anti-NATO and anti-EU. And actually, if you take a look at recent, you know, general population polls, especially among the youth is like, it used to be more inclined towards the EU, but now a slight majority is even against the EU. So now Serbs are slowly drifting from being a population which was very pro-EU, especially when we had these so-called democratic changes in the 2000s, in early 2000s. And people, you know, were really, you know, happy. They thought it's something new. We're going to finally have law and order. But they are slowly becoming dissatisfied with the whole EU thing, especially because they're starting to realize we're getting these, where Serbia is implementing, like, starting to implement, you know, EU policies. We're not talking about the foreign one, but internal EU policies. Like, we have, our laws now look more or less the same as the EU. Some regulations, food regulations, still don't exist, but they will more, you know, inevitably they will come here, and people don't like them. People don't like that one little bit. For example, an average Serb likes to, you know, brew his homemade rakia, you know, and they're trying to forbid that. And they actually apparently now you can, but most people don't give a damn about it. It's a funny thing, because Serbia, you know, people are very deeply inside, they're very anarchistic. They despise any kind of authoritarianism. And in the countryside, for example, during the COVID scandemic, in the big cities, yeah, you had like proper lockdowns. In the countryside, no, you can't lock down these people. Like, they don't, taverns were open 24/7. People were drinking beer, heading out into small villages in the countryside. In the cities, it was like a proper terror. In the countryside, it's like, to say in, you know, modern day internet slang, it was based. And it still is based. It's the healthy core of Serbia. And I would say the countryside in the 21st century is still the healthy core of every nation, especially if we're talking about the white ones. But to continue with the Serbian policy, both foreign, well, the foreign one, yes, you have this impression that Serbia is overtly pro-Russian, which isn't true. The population is very pro-Russian, which it's more pro-Russian than, for example, some countries which are in the Balkans, which have more logics to be pro-Russian, like Bulgaria, because, for example, historically wise, Bulgaria got more help from Russia than we did. But Serbians themselves view Russians as not as their big brothers. No, no, we view Russians as our equals. You know, we're like, no, no, they're like, we are like, so to say, like twins. You know, they're not.
There is the joke that it's a Serbian joke. Us and the Russians, 200 million, right?
300 million. Beg your pardon.
Yeah, that used to be. It's inflation.
It is. But like, Russians, like you, some people, I think Russians mostly have this impression that we are the younger brother, and we're like, no, we are equals, which is funny because compare Serbia with its military, economic power, population numbers to Russia. It is funny. But yeah, the population, yeah, it is pro-Russian, but the government, no. The government follows a foreign policy of proper pragmatism. They do whatever suits their financial interests and also their political interests, in the sense whatever keeps them in power, which actually means who keeps them in power. The West is actually the one, the power which controls the Serbian political scene. The West was the one which financed the Serbian Progressive Party and their propaganda campaigns. For example, it's interesting to note that all of the Vucic, the Serbian Progressive Party propaganda videos, you know, election videos, are made by an Israeli company. So it says a lot. At some point, one of the advisors to Vucic, well, he was prime minister because he sometimes likes to switch. You know, sometimes he's president, sometimes he's prime minister. During his time as prime minister, his close advisor was Tony Blair. And that says a lot, too, who brought him into power. Before them, you had the Democratic Party, which was also funded by the West. Then you had the Democratic Opposition of Serbia, which was the coalition of democratic parties which brought down the Milosevic government. They were, too, funded by the West. So basically, whoever's in power of Serbia has the West behind them. It's a proper, like, it's a puppet government. So people should not believe in this media nonsense. It's basically Western pressure on Vucic to, you know, cancel any sort of Russian influence in Serbia. And now I think the listeners would ask a question: if the Progressive Party is a proper puppet of the West, why don't they switch completely to the West? Well, the thing is, they will lose power. And also, not because the Serbians will revolt, like, why did you betray our brothers? No. We are dependent on Russia energy sources. And we can't make, if we implement any sanctions against Russia, they won't give a damn. They won't lose a coin. But we will lose a lot. Gas prices will skyrocket, which will eventually lead to other things, you know, other prices, you know, going high. And eventually it would lead to bigger economic problems. And we have enough of them already. And that would mean that eventually the regime will be toppled. So Vucic is doing a very, very smart game of balancing his relations with both Russia and the EU. And Russia, it is interesting, the Russian relation to Serbia, because Russia never opposes the Serbian entry to the EU. The foreign minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov, openly stated a few times that Russia doesn't even oppose, but supports the Serbian road towards the EU. And that's another topic on its own, why the Russians do this, but they never opposed our entry into the EU. Also, Serbia has a few agreements with NATO, and we're in this thing called the Partnership for Peace, I think. And we will never enter NATO, but like, we are a proper neutral country in that sense that we're trying to the government is trying to balance its economics between Russia. They're trying not to make the West angry too much because they, you know, they're afraid of sanctions. 30% of Serbian trade is with the EU, and that's like the biggest trade partner of Serbia. So basically, if the EU tries to sanction us because of supporting Russia openly, and we don't actually openly support Russia, Serbia actually, a few days ago, Vucic made a statement and said that Donbass and Crimea are an integral part of Ukraine. At the start of the war in Ukraine, Serbia sent something like 3 million euros to as humanitarian aid to Ukraine. And a similar thing happened. We sent something to them. I don't know. It was a few days ago. But we're trying to balance out stuff. We have laws like against
the Serbia cannot really support irredentism anywhere, right? Because Serbia has its own problem with irredentism, and this is what I've been trying to get people in Macedonia who are maybe nationalists but extremely pro-Russia, and I say to them, look, you cannot play geopolitics like it's a like it's sports. You got to think about your own interests first. Like, what do we have up in Ukraine? You have a large country invading a small country while at the same time denying its nationality, its language, its separate existence. Like, and because we are Macedonians, you know, you could get people from Sofia or Belgrade come in with those same arguments at us. So we should think very carefully about whom we support in this conflict. And I say to them, well, you look at the Serbs. They're not supporting Russia in this because they know it will inflame their own problem in Kosovo, right? Irredentism. Exactly. Now, before I want to talk about Kosovo in the second hour of the show, but before we do that, can you briefly tell me about Chinese influence in Serbia?
That's what I wanted to go to. Chinese, as they always are, that's my perception of them as a race. They are very silent and very patient in whatever they do. We have a lot of Chinese immigrants, which are the estimates go between 70 and 100,000. They mostly live in Belgrade and Novi Sad. And these people are nowhere to be seen except in their own markets and shops. And these things are very interesting. There is this chain of Chinese supermarkets when it's like the average Chinese supermarket. You go there, you can buy anything. Like, they don't sell food, but they sell like, you can buy batteries, you can buy glasses for, you know, water, you can buy cutlery, you can buy, you know, scarves, you know, whatever you can think of, you can buy in a Chinese shop. So there's this big chain of these shops called Panda, and what is interesting, they're always empty. So a man has to ask himself, how do these people survive? How does this business continue to operate? Because like, you have to have some revenue, right? Well, it's financed by the Chinese Communist Party. And there you go. That's how it slowly progresses, you know. They are very silent, and then they slowly start investing. So they built a few bridges, so on. And then they started buying up factories and opening their own factories. And there's this factory called Linglong Tire, which they make car tires. They bought, I think, our own company, Trial, which was it was one of the big Yugoslav tire making companies, and then was destroyed by, you know, plutocrats. And in fact, you know it yourself. It was the same in Macedonia. You had companies which didn't have to go. Like, you could just, you know, not renew them, but reform them, and they could have continued to work very nice. No, but politicians destroyed them completely, and then they sold the story of people, well, these companies can't function anymore. Let's shut them down and sell them. And in this company called Linglong Tire, which is an example of how it got sold, for example, workers don't have like breaks. They work in diapers, which is really demeaning, you know. It's really like disrespecting. And they can't go on breaks. Chinese influence also goes as far as to the fact that I think it was 3 or 4 years ago.
Did I hear you right? They work in diapers and they're not allowed to
piss. Yeah, they're not allowed to go to piss.
Jesus fucking Christ.
You have 3 or 4 years ago in Belgrade, you had Chinese policemen walking the streets in uniform, like not in Serbian uniform, in Chinese uniform. In Chinese police uniforms. And it was the government, the Serbian government said, well, they're there to help Chinese tourists. And I'm like, you have Chinese tourists in the US, in Paris, in Prague, in London. Why the hell do you need them? I mean, where the hell do you need cops here and not there? So it says a lot. Then they also bought our biggest steel mill in Smederevo. And like there, we sold it for $1. I'm not joking. We sold it for $1. Though it's like a Serbia owns like a big percentage of it, but it's a long story. It has sense, but right now I'd really like to talk about one bigger threat is Chinese surveillance in Serbia. Chinese companies which sell Chinese companies are the most dominant in the CCTV field, in the CCTV market. And we're talking about companies, and look, you can look them up online, the Hua and Hikvision. And Hikvision is the Chinese CCTV company owned by the Chinese Ministry of Defense, while the Hua is apparently private, though it's not really private. There is nothing private in China. You have also Huawei as a phone company, but also as a CCTV company, but they're not as big as these two. Now, what's interesting about these two companies is that they are both involved in genocide in Xinjiang, in Uyghuria. So now Serbia has, in Belgrade at least, the government has been starting, they started to put up these new cameras, you know, face recognition cameras and so on. It didn't sound really nice. And then you had this rumors of this new law, which eventually came like to light that it was true. The rumors were true. The Serbian government was getting ready to implement a biometric surveillance law to reform the police law so that they could monitor, you know, put biometric. Well, these cameras are not functioning at the moment, but, well, at least it's what the government says. And they want to monitor us like they do in China. And the thing is, for those things, you need a software, right? And we've got a Chinese software, which was offered to almost every single EU country for free, and they rejected it for a very good reason. Now, before I jump why they offered it to Serbia for free, and why do they offer it for free at all, is because this software is only trained to recognize Asian faces. So they need a guinea pig. And that's why they chose Serbia, and we accepted it. And that tells you more than enough about Chinese influence. You don't really see them a lot in the news. Their investment is really big, but you don't see them in the news. They don't, it's not like really, you know, how to put it. It's not like a massive Russian influence or a massive European influence, but it's really hidden. Even this company called
Rio, they're like Tinto, the Jews, aren't they?
Yeah,
like you don't see them, but they control, well, maybe not everything, but a lot of things.
And there is this political party in Serbia called the People's Party. They're kind of, you know, center right. You know, that's even what they say about themselves. The funny thing is, they're the leader of the party, Vuk Jeremić. He's the ex.
I know him.
He used to be the general secretary of the UN General Assembly. Now, the story about him and why I mentioned him is, how did he become the General Secretary of the General Assembly of the UN? He was the country which proposed his presidency was South Africa. And we all know who controls South Africa, the Chinese. And they supported that. They were the first ones to support it. And that man supports Chinese interests in Serbia. And this company I mentioned before, Rio Tinto, it's apparently Western, I think it's seated in London or Australia, something like that. But it's actually Chinese owned. It's actually controlled from China. And they tried to do this like massive lithium mines and stuff. And it's interesting that the previous government, which is also pro-Western, they rejected. I don't know the exact figure, but like 2-3 billion euros. And they outright rejected it. And Vucic then said, when there were massive protests against Rio Tinto, Vucic said, if we reject them, we will have to pay 3 billion euros, which means he already accepted it. So that's how big Chinese influence is in Serbia. You don't see it in the news. You don't see pro-Chinese protests or anything.
but they are here, and they are not as the Chinese government, the Chinese state. It's a menace.
So this is from my friends in Serbia, you know, our fellow nationalists, our friends. I knew that a bunch of Serbs were going to China to work. Mm-hmm. And I knew that there was Chinese money, you know, entering Serbia, but I just did not realize the full extent of it, or the fact that China is using Serbia as a staging ground to slowly infiltrate Europe, you could say.
Well, they're like already doing that. They're doing the same thing in Montenegro, and I think they are already almost controlling it fully in the economical sense. They offered
also a lot of, like, the another entry point is Hungary, right, from what I can tell. It's this with the Ukraine war, we focused on Russia, and we should be focused on Russia. They do represent a threat to Eastern European nations, certainly, but we cannot underestimate the fact that China is the major civilizational rival of Europe. Just no two ways about it.
That is an absolute fact. That is a definite fact, and they are. We have, like, in my opinion, the U.S. as it is nowadays with its government, with its political system, is an enemy of Europe too. Same as any big imperial power which tries to not only influence European politics but also use Europe as a bulwark or a stage for its own schemes. China is the same, but they do it different. They don't export any culture, and that's why they are much more ruthless. They don't export any culture. They don't show their influence. They're not going to try to subvert your culture to degeneracy. I think they will try to destroy you as a nation completely, whether it suits their interests or not. And we see that in how they treat their own citizens and what they do with them. I don't have any sympathies for Islamic extremists, of course. But if a government is ready to erase a whole people from existence, that says a lot about it. And they did that before to the Manchus. The Manchus are gone, completely gone. And you don't have to be a fan of Uyghurs. You can just be a fan of Manchus. And because these were decent people, and people with a 1,000-year history, they used to rule China. The Qing dynasty, the Qing, how some call it, they used to be the last dynasty of the Chinese Empire, and nobody anymore.
I believe one of the reasons why the Han, the Chinese Communist Party, had a deliberate program of Manchu erasure, and why if they ever take us in their power as white people, they will have a program of white erasure, because they blame the Manchu, but also us, for their century of humiliation. Remember that at one point, European powers also indirectly ruled China. I think that a lot of people think they understand the Chinese. They say they are driven by greed, they are driven by power lust. I say, if I'm not exactly privy to the internal discourse of China, because I don't speak Chinese, but I know people who speak Chinese, who understand Chinese, and they say, they are driven by resentment and a desire for revenge against the white world.
I think they're driven by revenge for the Boxer Rebellion. Yeah. We were the ones who tried to put, well, not we ourselves. No, it was people who know, like, people can Google and, like, just go a bit down that rabbit hole. They will find out eventually who were the people, this ethnic group, this particular ethnic group, which was, like, purposefully pushing for literal, well, it wasn't heroin, but it was, like, similar to it, opium trade in China. And it was this particular ethnic group which always makes chaos around the globe. But if we want to see, like, some people say, yeah, but why would they do anything against whites? Well, they are already doing that. They are behind the white flight in South Africa and Zimbabwe. They made the Zimbabwean government, even though the blacks in Zimbabwe already had a resentment towards whites, the Chinese were the ones who pushed them towards the complete expulsion of the white population from Zimbabwe. And they are the ones who are also encouraging blacks in Africa to, the government not to act against any anti-white violence, and also encouraging groups like the Economic Freedom Fighters in South Africa to be openly anti-white racist. And there you go. They are already doing that. They people, some people in Serbia are too naive to think that they're on our side because they don't recognize Kosovo, but it's just because it's a means to an end. We are a tool in this global scheme between major powers fighting over different goals, whether it is economic domination, whether it's cultural domination, whether it's absolute destruction of an entity, let's say the white race. So it's also like it's a game. It's literally like a Game of Thrones, so to say. If I would, I mean, I like the books myself, not the show too much, but it is that. It's a big political game, and we live in a century of this clash of civilizations. You didn't have that in the 19th century. You didn't have that in. Well, I think the last time you had something, well, not on, you never had actually something of this scale. No, not as brutal as this is. This is like proper. This is on an industrial scale. This is a thing that we, even the Greco-Persian Wars, which was a clash of civilization, it wasn't of civilizations. It wasn't on this level.
I think that the only comparable event from history that really just pops into my mind is the Islamic expansion and the reaction, the Crusades. That was a proper clash of civilizations, and it extended all the way into wars with the Turks. Although I have my own theory about the Ottoman Empire, about where it fits into the global civilizations, maybe the Mongol expansions. But yeah, you might be right. This might be the greatest ever clash of civilizations.
But you see, I would say that, for example, the Christian-Muslim conflict from the Middle Ages that really started with the invasion of the Pyrenees, or nowadays Spain and Portugal. It started then and ended only like in 1918 with the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. But it was a much more healthier rivalry because it was two spiritual worlds fighting against each other with its own spiritual values. And now we have like the West, which has lost any semblance of spirituality. You have the communist Chinese, who are not spiritual at all. They're like very materialistic on its own. You have the East, Eastern Europe, which is mostly represented by Russia and like the countries around Russia, which is not spiritual because it's spiritual, but it's passive and it's losing its spirituality very quick. And 21st century is in its essence the epitome of Kali Yuga, the Iron Age, where it is money and greed ruling the world on one side, and on another, it's money, greed, plus hate towards this other racial group, or us, what I mean with the other racial group. That's why I think
the Western elite class is motivated not only by money and greed, but they actually do have a twisted form of spirituality, which I think they aim to encompass the entire world in a single ecumene, right? And basically blend us all together into a brown goop in order to bring about some form of heaven. This ties into, strangely, or maybe it's this schizophrenic ideology, which also involves transhumanism and artificial intelligence, but that's a topic for another time. The motivations of our enemies. And we have donations, we have questions from the audience, we have we have Slog donating 14 lemons over on DLive, and thank you for that, Slog. And that number 14 looks to me like it might have some significance, and it may be part of a conceptual whole, and we are waiting for the other half. And we have 10 American dollars over on Odyssey from Reed Johnson, and he poses a question. Marco, in your best estimation, how have the powers that be, after the war, succeeded in taking Serbia, once a symbol of hard masculinity and absolute toughness to outsiders, and imposing this awful feminized regime upon it? What are the mechanics of the sinister social engineering in Serbia? Well, that's a little romantic view of Serbia you have there to read, but I'll let Marco respond.
I would say that all Balkan countries were, all Eastern European countries were saved from Western degeneracy by communism. As ruthless as it was, it didn't have degeneracy in the, it didn't have degeneracy at all. But
I would say the Serbia, it's a wrong picture of Serbia. Serbia is still like every other Balkan country, very masculine. I would say Macedonia is the same. I would say Montenegro, even Albania, I would say like they're still pretty, we are still pretty much holding up to our traditions, and we are resisting as much as we can Western influence, though it's mostly passive nowadays. You know, people just mind their own business. What they're doing is what I said before, they're infiltrating our school systems, and they're doing these like programs. And you know how you cook a frog, for example. You cook a frog, you put it into a keg. Well, not a keg, like a cauldron. And you don't turn up the heat to maximum straightforward. No, you make the frog used to the heat. And by the moment it starts cooking, it doesn't feel the heat anymore because it's used to it. And it's the same as if I try to tell you, for example, I'm going to slap you. And I don't. And then I tell you again, I'm going to slap you. And I continue telling how I'm going to slap you any moment now. And then at some point you just break and say, okay, slap me already. And I'm going to slap you. You're not going to feel surprised. If I slapped you before without even saying a thing, your reaction would be much more aggressive than, you know, than without this warning. So that's what they're doing. That's what they did with our Western countries. Look at this particular politician who warned the French what's going to happen to them, Jean-Marie Le Pen. Everything what he was saying, he was right. Everything what he said happened. Italians, on the other hand, for example, and I mean, the thing is, the things he said was in the 70s and the 80s, nobody believed it. I'm not saying he was working for anyone. No, he wasn't. He was warning us. And the French government was telling other stories, same as Norwegian. No, these people are coming to work for our salaries. The Italians, if you would ask them in the 70s, that it would be a migrant camp, essentially, a melting pot of all barbarian cultures, they would say, no, you must be out of your mind. In Serbia, if you would have told somebody, let's say, I don't know, 15 years ago, that we would have a gay prime minister, you would be slapped and called an idiot or laughed at. And that's what they do. They slowly, slowly make you either miserable, bored, or inactive. And they like slowly, put these like hints. They don't do it immediately, The process that West went through from the end of World War to now is the same, which Serbia is going through. Except that they would break any resistance in form of political resistance. Like in Serbia, wouldn't have a proper Front National. They destroyed the whole right wing, the parliamentarian right wing, and then you didn't have any more people to resist it. They either destroyed it by arresting people, or infiltrating these parties, or even buying them in the sense of like bribing leaders of political parties, right-wing political parties. And nowadays, like every single right-wing political party, they criticize the regime, but not on major topics. So there you go. Like on the migrant question, they started telling us how they will not settle down here, they're just moving through here. And then suddenly, 6-7 years later, you have this woman, Zorana Mihajlović, saying, yeah, well, we need people. We have demographic problems, and these people are going to be fine new settlers in Serbia. And we need, we have empty farms, and we need somebody to work on them. And then you have now some people are saying, yeah, they're going to work for our salaries. They're going to work for our pensions. The same thing they said in the West. And people, being naive as they are, and that's what people are, when they're miserable, they will accept gladly, anything that might promise a brighter future, especially in this world of, mass media, propaganda on a massive industrial scale where you're bombarded by these ideas. If you watch a TV show from Serbia made 10 years ago, everybody was, it's all white, but like you wouldn't have any gays now. Well, not, it started first.
I wouldn't know about that. I mean, my mother watches a lot of Serbian television because we get it here in Macedonia, and there's a lot more gypsies than there were 10 years ago.
Exactly.
Tell me about how bad is the gypsy problem in Serbia? When I go to Vranje, I think it's all gypsies, but on a scale of the country, how bad is it?
Well, the thing is, like, it's what do you classify as bad? If you talk about migrants as bad, it's bad because it's many of them and they're violent. Gypsies, yeah, there is many of them, but not like that you say, like, it's like, you know, it's millions of them. No, it's a couple of hundred thousand, but they are, gypsies are very, you could say a fascinating culture because they reject any kind of authority. And in that sense, they don't even like, they don't even want to be registered. And they mind their own business. Some gypsies tend to be violent, but here in Serbia, you know, people know how to deal with them. You slap like the one who looks the biggest and then everybody run, every single one of them runs away. Yeah, they sometimes steal stuff and that's what they do. But gypsies, in historically, they mostly used to be like, they would either do some very easy manual labor, like cleaning trash, which they do nowadays, or they would be like, you know, they would make like small rings and stuff, or they would be musicians, or at worst, they would steal. But these people, like, if you try, for example, the communist government tried to assimilate them, to make them like, these people don't want to go to school at all. They don't want to be a part of your culture. They want to have their own thing. They either live in their own shacks, they find a place and like on some field on the outskirts of a city, they built their camp and that's where they live. They don't want to be a part of society. You could compare them to stray dogs because they're there. They do something, you know, they eat trash, let's say, and they're like, you know, scavengers. They don't infiltrate into public life. They don't want any political power. They don't care about their rights. You know, they're trying, you know, people, the Serbian liberal government is trying so hard, has been trying so hard for the past 23 years to integrate them in society. And the funny thing is, it's like, they don't want to be integrated in society. There's like, it's true. It sounds super barbaric. The Serbian government, I think it was in 2008 or 9, the Serbian government gave some apartments for free, like free housing for gypsies. Okay, so they move in. And suddenly, for some reason, somebody calls the fire brigade there. There's a fire inside of one of these apartments. The fire brigade comes and finds out that the whole floor, which was wooden, has been lifted and they started a fire in the apartment. And everybody's asking why they have heating. Well, they don't. They ripped every single pipe in the house, every single cable, and sold it. And then winter came, didn't have any heating, so they lit a fire in the middle of the apartment. That's how they live. And it's not me being biased. That's what they are. They don't want anybody, you know, meddling in their own culture, society. They will live in their own shacks and mind their own business. The problem can be sometimes when they get group into small gangs and like attack people in the streets. But like, if you know how to slap a gypsy and respond to him, it's going to, you know, it's very easily to deal with them. They're not like a bigger threat is actually Afghan migrants that we have now in Belgrade. A lot of them, and they are a proper menace. And you can even differentiate them from gypsies. I mean, you have probably some migrants in Macedonia yourself, so you know, like, you can see the faces are way different.
Very, very few. I mean, most Macedonia is a transit country. They don't want to stay in Macedonia because we don't really have any social transfers. We have no welfare. We have no. We do have social housing, but it's mostly for gypsies, right? And migrants don't stick around.
You gotta have one thing in mind. I think they will eventually stick anywhere they can because take a look at Afghanistan or, like, let's say, an African country. We would say that our countries, Serbia and Macedonia, are both poor. You know, you don't have any perspective as a young man. You'd be much better off living in the West. Like, even the shittiest job in the West is better paid than like an average job in our countries. But the thing is, these people have nothing like that in their own. They don't have roads. They don't have running water or electricity. Here, living as a poor man in our countries, it's like luxury in their own. So they wouldn't mind. Yeah, they would like to go to Germany, but they wouldn't mind staying in Serbia. And the thing is, a lot of them stay in Serbia because Hungarians being, you know, having a very reasonable anti-migrant policy, they don't let them in. And gypsies, migrants can't leave Serbia, a lot of them. And not even that, the EU is trying to make us accept migrant quotas. I said before, like, there was this politician, she was advocating for migrants, like free land being redistributed to migrants, like we need farmers and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think that the reason why I haven't I don't think I've ever seen even seen an Arab in almost 6 months here in Skopje, is because I mean, these people, they don't really want to work. They don't want to have an honest life. They want to collect welfare or engage in crime. And in Macedonia, you don't, I mean, you have state capacity. They do get arrested. They do get, but also the locals have not been brainwashed into hating themselves to such a degree that we don't defend ourselves against migrants. So I think it's not very safe for them to ply their criminal trades here. And for this reason, right, it's not very pleasant for migrants. I don't know about the situation in Serbia, but from what you describe, you know, the Serbian state might be protecting them.
It is. It's actually the Serbian police is protecting them from Serbians, because Serbians aren't really fond of migrants, not at all. Actually, in the neighborhood where I live, it was, I think, 4 or 5 years ago, a group of migrants tried to attack, and God knows what they would do to a girl going to primary school or going from it. And what happened is that the whole neighborhood got out, like even old people with sticks, batons. They wanted to lynch these people, like in the proper sense of the word. And the gendarmerie, the Serbian militarized police, had to step in to protect these people from the Serbian population. So Serbs are, even the most liberal Serbs, and I met some of them at my university, they're not really fond of migrants. Like, they, you know, they're like, yeah, you know, they're, you know, we should be more open, you know, multiculturalism and stuff, but they're not like really fond of that kind of multiculturalism. They're like, their multiculturalism goes as far as living with Bosnian Muslims who are white, you know, and living with Muslims from Serbia who are like from the Sanjak region. But like, these people from these lands of afar, from these uncharted lands, we don't want multiculturalism with them. So it's kind of, you know, liberal racism.
I don't know if you would even call it multiculturalism, because like you said, Bosnians and Serbian Muslims from Sanjak, these are white Muslims. These are, you know, people from the Balkans who converted to Islam during the Turkish period. We have, you know, such populations in Macedonia too. We call them Macedonian Muslims, right? They are our people. They speak our language. They just, I joke around with my friends, like, what is the difference between Macedonian Orthodox Christians and Macedonian Orthodox Muslims? Well, our families, the Orthodox families, changed our faith 5 times, and their families changed their faith 6 times, right? So that's, you know, you go from Divus Pater to Jesus to multiculturalism, right, to progressivism. They went from Divus Pater to Jesus to Muhammad to Allah to progressivism. It's not that big a difference really between us. But when you talk about racial outsiders from Syria, from Afghanistan, from all of these places, it's a different matter altogether.
I would argue a bit different for Muslims from the south of Serbia, white Muslims from Bosnia and South Serbia. They are, let's say the least, they are not really fond of us. We're neither fond of them, not just because of religion. It goes, the hate between us goes really far back, because during the Ottoman Empire, they used to be our landlords. We used to be the slaves. Then we there was the liberation from the Ottoman Empire, and they suddenly got, you know, very angry because they weren't the landlords, the overlord anymore. And that's how the whole hate thing started between us, right? Because they started, you know, they sided with whomever they could, so they wouldn't be, not we weren't ruling over them. We tried actually to, you know, integrate them into Serbian society, not even convert them back to Christianity. No, there was a proper Serbian nationalist policy saying, like, you know, three faiths, the Catholic, the Muslim, and the Orthodox, three faiths, one nation. And the Muslims rejected that. They would side with whomever they can to fight against us. And eventually that happened also with the Croats. In the last war, they not only fought against us, but also against the Croats, because Croats were also their slaves during the Ottoman Empire.
anybody who wasn't Muslim was basically, you know, enslaved by Bosnian Muslims, who were by far the most radical in the Ottoman Empire. They were the bulwark of the Ottoman Empire in Europe. So that's about that.
Right. So there's a little bit of local history. Now, there are some comments. They do not come with donations attached, but they appear important. We have Fyodor Pavlovich, and he's asking on Telegram, on my Telegram channel, can you ask Marco why his interview with Agent Sanu is deleted?
Apparently, what the guy said is that somebody hacked his YouTube account and deleted the video. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if that's entirely true. I don't want to dwell into that. The guy, he's a good guy. Maybe he got threatened. I don't know. But that same interview will be published soon enough on the Zentropa Serbia YouTube channel.
Okay. So, Fyodor Pavlovich, if you're listening to the show, there's your answer. Let me see. There was a comment from Carlota about gypsies. He has since removed it, or she, you know, Carlota sounds like it could be a woman's name, gypsies reject liberal politicians. I'm sorry, this is false. Gypsies are like any other non-white population in a white country. They gladly serve in the bio-Leninist coalition. They ally with the radical left, with the enemy, in order to undermine their host nation. Maybe they don't do it to as great an extent as Arabs or Blacks or Mexicans, although in my experience here in Macedonia, they are very politically integrated. They block vote. There's this joke, of course, they are always with the government. But it's not a joke. They always vote for the government, and they readily stab their former friends in the back, politically speaking. They steal. They engage in prostitution, in begging.
If they would get free money, they would gladly accept it, which is why they always vote for a government. But they are fairly anarchistic and both pro-state, which is kind of, you know, sounds paradoxical, but it is what it is, you know. If the state would turn against them,
they're not. I wouldn't call them anarchistic. They are opposed to anything which imposes order on them.
Exactly. Well, order which is foreign to them.
That's the thing, right? White people, even if we had no specific kind of state, we would generate some sort of order on our own, a proto-state, organize ourselves to survive, because we thrive on order in orderly societies, whereas a lot of people who are outside of Europe, they just see the state as an imposition, and the state really is just an imposition to them. We are the people of order. We need order in order to survive. We cannot, I believe, survive in an anarchic environment.
Exactly.
As white people.
Exactly. And it's not even that. They are like, there are people who never tended to produce anything, whereas Europeans have always been, and I argue that the Europeans are the most productive people that history has ever seen. In any sense, whether it's science, whether it's just like manual labor, whether it's, you know, innovations, technical innovations, everything what you see in history, technology wise, scientific wise, art, literature, it has been brought by European labor, by European minds.
Right, you are. Okay, I think that we've exhausted that topic. And finally, I want to ask you about the Kosovo crisis. Now, for those who may not know, Kosovo is a province of Serbia, which at the time of the Yugoslav breakup was majority Albanian by a very slim margin. And in 1999, NATO bombed, America and Britain primarily bombed Serbia over supposed war crimes of the Serbian state in Kosovo and some ethnic cleansing, which resulted in 2008 in Kosovo declaring independence. First, it was occupied by KFOR forces. These are United Nations forces. And then you had In 2008, Kosovo proclaiming independence. Kosovo is recognized by many countries, but crucially not Serbia, and not, you know, other countries around the world refuse to recognize Kosovo. It is now not only majority Albanian, it is now overwhelmingly Albanian. All of the Serbs have been chased out of Kosovo, except for four counties in the north. And recently there were crises. The Serbs in Kosovo, I believe they were forced to get, was it license plates or driver's licenses from the Kosovar self-proclaimed government?
Serbian documents in general, which say, for example, license plates, which were in question, were with the letters KM, which means Kosovska Mitrovica, which is in a city in the Kosovo province. And the Albanians, you know, say, no, it's not right. You can't have a license plate saying that it's from our own city. And also with the documents saying that they were, you know, made in the, well, for us, it's the autonomous province of Kosovo. But what you said before is four counties. That's actually not entirely true. The majority of Serbs, so you have the north, which is the absolute majority is Serbian, north of the Ibar River. But that population makes up just 30% of the whole Serbian population in Kosovo. The majority of Serbs live south in the enclaves, the Serbian enclaves. One of the biggest ones, actually the biggest one, is called Gračanica, where 15,000 people, with 15,000 Serbs live. There is also this part called Sirnička Župa, with the largest city called Štrpce, and in all of that area there is about 5,000 to 6,000 people living. In general, the estimate, well, it's not the estimate, it's well, the last Serbian functioning institution on Kosovo is the church. To talk about that and why is church there important and in our history, it's because when we were occupied by the Ottomans, the main institution, both political and cultural, which was protecting us and uniting us in the fight, was the church. It was the main gathering place of not just rebels, but also intellectuals and soldiers, officers. These were our political representatives. That's the last thing that remained. That's the same thing in Kosovo right now again. So the church itself has its, you know, well-organized apparatus. They do charity. They help the local communities. They basically the representatives of Serbs, not the ones who are in Kosovo, the Kosovo Serbian politicians, which are, of course, controlled by the Serbian Progressive Party. And these are like, these people are the scum of the earth. Every Serb on Kosovo hates them. And then people ask themselves, well, why do Serbs from Kosovo vote on Kosovo elections for them? Well, because we have a saying that the biggest enemy of Serbs are Serbs. Srbinje Srbinu najveći neprijatelj. Why is that? Well, the big good example is if you don't vote for the so-called Serbian list, which participates in Kosovo elections, if you don't vote for them, you might get a grenade in your backyard. And that's how things go there. The church is the one who protects the Serbian population, really. And according to them, there is about 150,000 Serbians living in Kosovo. And that is much bigger than the Albanian estimates, what they say. And they would like that number to be as low as it can. Another interesting fact is that Kosovo never had its population census since 1991. According to that census, there's 1.2 million people living there, and from that there is only like something like 50,000, 60,000 Serbs, which is nothing. And the reason why they want us, like the number as low as it can be, because we are a constitutional nation of Kosovo, and there cannot be a government formed on Kosovo without us. And if they could, they would eradicate every single Serb, or like let's, or at least say there's just 100 of us left to put us out of the political equation there. But the situation is way different. I myself am a frequent visitor of Kosovo. I go there, visit Serbs, and it's not just like one day trip. I stay there for a few days, and I actually sleep in the enclaves themselves, there's this village I go to called Velika Hoča, and it's a proper enclave, meaning that you live in a village where you're in a village where there is like 240 people living, and every single village around it is Albanian. And for example, during night, it's like
it's surreal, the experience there. Like, you go there and they tell me, like, the people that I'm staying at, they tell me you park the car in the back, in the yard. And I'm like, and first of all, you have to understand how these, you know, their backyards look. It's like they have walls around it. It's not like fences. It's proper 2-meter walls. And I'm like, why? You know, what's going to happen? And they say, oh, somebody might break your, you know, the windshield. And I'm like, why would Serbs break it? And it's like, it's not Serbs. The Albanians started, you know, breaking into the village during night. And I remember, like, last time I was there, it was before Corona. It wasn't like that. So it was like 2-3 years ago. And now it's like getting more dangerous. Attacks on Serbian communities are getting more frequent. And it's actually today a boy was chased down by a group of Albanians, a 15-year-old boy, and beaten up by them just because he was Serbian. And he was like going from school or something like that. And if I don't know if people are familiar with that, not a few weeks ago, on the 6th of January, which is for us a very important date, it's Badnji Dan, it's the day before Christmas, one kid and a 21-year-old Serbian man, well, young teenager, whatever, he's not a teenager, but whatever, young adult, they were shot at and wounded by Albanians, and one of them turned to be a member of the Kosovo Security Forces, which is technically the Kosovo Albanian Army. And, you know, that's why there was also chaos recently again, and it's going all over again and again. The pretext for Albanians, it's license plates, but more or less it's the complete control of the Serbian population there. Because, for example, the north wasn't really controlled by the Albanians. Before this whole crisis, you would enter the north. Yes, you would cross this kind of border crossing, but you wouldn't have a feel that you're in you're on Kosovo or you're on another country. It's all Serbian. There is no Albanian police there. But as the moment you cross the Ibar River, it's not a different country. It's a different civilization, like a proper different civilization. And these people, like, is it because they're Muslim or because some of them don't even look European? I don't know if it's that, but they behave differently. And you feel that you're in a hostile environment. And it really is. It's in some places. Last time I went there, I went there with my friend from Germany, Mike. If he's listening to this, hello from Serbia. I hope I'll see you again soon. We went with his daughter, and I remember we sat in a restaurant to, you know, have a break from the road trip and eat. And a waiter asked us, where are we from? And I said, we're from Germany. Because we were in a city which used to be made, like, the majority of people were Serbs, and none of them are left. So in these environments, it's not like the war was 100 years ago. It was very recent. It was like 20, 22 years ago. And people who were the ones who were, like, burning Serbian houses are still there. You know, there is this example in the southern part of Kosovo, in this village called Gotovusha. There's this old, now he's like about, I think, 50 or maybe 40, I'm not sure. He works on a gas station owned by an ex-member of the KLA, the Kosovo Liberation Army, the terrorist organization. And the guy, like, the owner himself is known to be like a drug trafficker and everything. And what they actually do, like most of the ex-KLA members and officers. And the Serbian man who works there, like, for like some miserable money, he's an ex-Serbian soldier who fought on Kosovo against Albanians. And I asked the villagers, like, how the fuck doesn't he get killed? And they told me, like, the Albanians don't know, but if they knew, he'd probably be flayed alive. And that like, the average, like you go to sleep there, if you're not used to it, you go to sleep there and you're like, it's the first time in my life that I couldn't sleep. And it was like, fuck, like, somebody might, like, break into the village tonight. And then you have the situation when we were leaving Kosovo on that very morning. We were leaving this house and, like, saying goodbye to everyone. And we go, that was in this other place. We went to visit this family, this city called Orahovac, which used to be, it's full of Serbs. And now there's only 240 Serbs left, and they live in a part of the city. And it's literally like a proper ghetto. Like, in the literal meaning of that word, they're surrounded by Albanians. They don't leave the neighborhood for their own safety. But the thing is, Albanians regularly go through to harass them or like to show them their presence there. And I remember that very morning we were going out of this house and four Albanian young men went through the center with like axes and shovels. And the woman told us, like, just like stay for a bit in the yard, like just wait for a bit. And never in my life did I have to stay somewhere behind to let somebody pass through, because like he might attack me for no reason at all for being Serbian. That's the average life there. But there is a brighter side to it. Serbs have a really big, really high fertility rate there. Never did I meet a family, a Serbian family in Kosovo, and I met a lot of them. There's not a single family which has less than four children. And Serbs, the tables have turned. The Albanians used to be the ones who are having a lot of children. Now they're not having a lot of children, and they're running away from Kosovo. Whereas these Serbs who remain there, they don't really want to go anywhere. Like, you can offer them tons of money, they won't sell their property. You can offer them millions of euros, and it actually happened a few times. Like, Albanians would come and like offer some insane amount of money to buy a house just because a Serb is living there, and they would reject it. No, we are born here, we die here. So these people have a lot of children, and the Serb, every year there's more and more Serbian people living there. If the situation stays the same as it is, Albanians running away, having low fertility rates, sometime in the future, just by waiting, we will again become the majority. When is that time going to come? If the things stay the same, we don't know. But we're talking about something called in Latin ceteris paribus, if everything remains unchanged. And there's also another myriad of problems. If you're a Serb, you can't really find work in Kosovo. So you're really good if you have like a farm field, but then again, you can get threatened by Albanians. They might steal your tractor or like your cows. So if you're a young Serb, you really don't have much perspective. And as much as young Serbian people want to stay on Kosovo, they can't really work or live off anything. So one of the main things what we do as humanitarian, like the humanitarian aid there, isn't just like, you know, we give free money or like clothing. They don't need clothing. You know, they're not like, they're not refugees. No, these people need work. So we buy them like flocks of sheep. We buy them a tractor. We buy them like, you know, we buy books for their children, for their school. So they remain there. And it's very empty if you go there. And it's because Albanians are leaving. And basically, I think there is in total between 600 and 900,000 people living on Kosovo. And if you take into account that there's about 150,000 Serbs, that turns the tip slowly in our favor on the long run.
Right. It's something that I've observed about Albanians, right? And starting somewhere in 2017, I think. And not only, I mean, they also have the immigration problem from Macedonia. Macedonian Albanians living in Macedonia also immigrate at very high rates. As regular viewers know, I used to be an attorney. I had a lot of Albanian clients, and I would go to their villages. And what would be amazing is there would be no young people there. It would be just old people, right? And I asked them, where are your young men? Oh, they're in Germany, they're in Sweden, they're in Switzerland, Italy, all of these places. They've just emigrated. But also starting from 2017, I've seen a massive rise of, you could just call it degeneracy among young Albanians. Used to be that young Albanian women, they would, you know, these are Muslim girls, they would walk around with the hijab, right? Or any kind of hair covering, they would dress conservatively. Now you look at them and their tits are hanging out, right? It's almost like their tits are hanging out. Young Albanian men, they are less and less masculine, right? They are looking like homosexuals. What can I say? And on one hand, I mean, this is an enemy nation and I would like to see them defeated. But on the other hand, you sort of feel sorry for them. Like they laid down with the enemy and now they caught all sorts of weird diseases. I blame Rita Ora and Dua Lipa, right? They have just pumped this degeneracy into Albanian culture.
Yeah, definitely. That's definitely true.
That's definitely true. This is a factor. This is a factor. So these recent protests by Serbs in Kosovo, these recent blockades, do you think they will escalate into open armed conflict? And from what you've told me, the Serbian state is probably not going to intervene, but give us your opinion, Eddie.
Well, the Serbian state is, to put it into perspective, we had similar things like this, barricades in the past, you know, it's nothing new. And for us, you know, it was usually what you would say in like internet slang, a nothing burger, you know. But this recent one, you know, we would usually be like, you know, it's Vucic kicking the can down the road again and so on and so on. But now we really thought it was going to blow out. We really were like, we thought it was, you know, going to explode there. In particular, because Serbs down there were really angry with not just the Albanians, but the Serbian government. And it looked that they would, at some point, it looked that they would like do a thing on their own. The Serbian government, of course, what they do with their army, like even like I have some sources in the army, some of our comrades are actually soldiers, and they themselves said it was never this serious. Like even in the army, like usually they would say, yeah, it's another road trip to the border with Kosovo, and then they go back to Belgrade or their respective bases, whatever. But now, like these people, they literally said, like we didn't know what we were, you know, to expect. We didn't know if it was gonna turn ugly or not. So the whole thing is like the Serbian state isn't gonna intervene at all in Kosovo for a very good reason. Because of the U.S. base, not because of the U.S. base in Bosnia. We were actually given guarantees by KFOR, and in particular the commander of the U.S. Bosnia of the NATO base there, and they themselves stated that the policy of Bosnia in an event of a Serbian invasion would be that they would stay silent for 7 to 14 days. They wouldn't intervene. And then they would intervene in the way that they would fit them, meaning that it doesn't mean they will support Albanians necessarily, but they will support whoever they see, whatever they think it's proper at that certain moment. They never said they would help the Albanians or nor Serbs. They never, you know, threatened us with anything. That's another interesting thing. And also, it's to be noted that this time, and the Albanians have been trying to implement these anti-Serbian policies since 2008. This time, Americans were the ones who told the Albanians to stop it. So the whole license plate thing, the whole thing against Serbian documents, the Albanians wanted to, like, you know, break through with it, you know, go with it. And the Americans were the ones stepping in and telling them, like, to stop, like, putting them basically on the leash. Now, what is going there basically is that Albin Kurti, the prime minister of Kosovo, is doing this while Russia is busy. Russia supports Serbia on Kosovo. And it was interesting that last year, when the whole thing started during the summer, for the first time since the war, since 1999, and it was the last time Russia did something serious on the Balkans when they sent paratroopers to Kosovo and they like took an airport near Pristina. And for the first time since then, since that happened, they said something which matters. From that period to last year, it was usually, yes, Kosovo is a part of Serbia, but we support the dialogue and so on and so on. We support peace. This time, Russia said that they will support us with any means necessary, which you know what that means. China had a very interesting remark, too, on that thing, It looked like they also inclined for not sending the army, but like sending arms and weapons to Serbia. So that sends a message to whoever is in charge there now. Is it the Albanian prime minister or NATO itself? So now the Albanian Prime Minister Albin Kurti is taking his chance while Russia is very busy in Ukraine to do as much as he can to level or eradicate any sort of Serbian influence or any sort of Serbian power on Kosovo. And when I say Serbian influence, I don't just mean like, you know, Serbs living there and having political power of their own, but also the Serbian state. People have to know that there is a lot of these, and that the in recent years, Kosovska Mitrovica, the biggest Serbian city on Kosovo, has seen in recent times new citizens. Males who are military age, they have no wives, yet they live alone and do nothing. And basically what I've been told by Serbs, local Serbs, is that's actually Serbian soldiers in civilian clothes waiting for the order. That's a thing. Another thing to be noted is that when this crisis started, you could see graffiti of a group which calls itself the Northern Brigade. And nobody knows who they are from Serbia, at least, but on Kosovo, the local Serbs told me it's the Serbian army basically giving support to Serbs and saying on graffiti on walls, saying we're here, we're ready, that basically Serbs, whatever happens, that the North will be defended. Now, we can't say that for sure because nothing happened yet, but what we can say is that there has been a lot of arms brought in from Serbia to Kosovo and given out to Serbians living there. And it's also to be noted that both Albanians, like civilians, we're not talking about the state itself, we're talking about civilians. Every single civilian home has at least, well, 2-3 rifles. People there are ready. But I don't think anything is going to blow out there anytime soon, because the West itself showed with their statements and their actions that they don't want any kind of conflict on the Balkans anytime soon, any kind of destabilization, whether it is Bosnia, whether it is Kosovo, whether it's Macedonia. And Albanians don't like that, but neither do Serbs and Russians the least, because Russians also want destabilization, because people have to have one thing in mind. The Balkans are not the backyard of Russia. Neither is Serbia, being an integral part of the Balkans. It's not the backyard of Russia. It's the backyard of NATO. And NATO doesn't want any chaos going on its territory, on its ground. Serbia might not be a part of NATO, but it is in its sphere of influence. Now, why Vucic didn't invade Kosovo, the answer is very obvious. We know who controls the government. But we also, there has been a lot of pressure from the West for Vucic to accept Kosovo. And I think the question is obvious. Again, if the government is a puppet of the West, why doesn't it recognize Kosovo? Well, Serbian governments, well, the Serbian state or politicians have a history of being toppled down for having bad policy in Kosovo. The most recent one was Milosevic. Well, actually, the most recent one was Tadic before Milosevic. Milosevic actually was toppled because of he lost the war, because of the Kumanovo agreement. Whoever doesn't know, he can look up what that means. But Serbs doing the bombing, we were ready to go full-scale war. The bombing wasn't a full-scale war. We didn't have NATO troops on the ground. But I remember what my parents told me, and they're not radical nationalists, they're ordinary people, like what you would call normies. They were ready. They were like, yeah, bring it on. We're waiting. And suddenly when he signed the Kumanovo agreement, which a lot of people see as a disgrace, as a betrayal, a year later, he falls from power. People were like, what did you do? Like, why did you do that? We were like ready to like fight and die for you, for a country. And it seemed to a lot of people that the whole fighting and dying was basically in vain. We technically didn't lose Kosovo because you had the UN Resolution 1244, which said that Kosovo is an integral part of Serbia, but we didn't have our army and police anymore there. So it's you can look up the document. We are allowed to have.
It was a de facto loss. De facto.
It was what you would call a pyrrhic victory. Like, we won, but we lost. We won at a very big cost. But people were ready to go to the end, and they saw the Kumanovo agreement as a betrayal. Milosevic fell from the people's grace. And there were already major protests from 1991 against his government, and everybody sided with the president when the war started, and then he fell from people's grace
when he lost the war on Kosovo, basically. Then Tadic didn't lose the war, but like he was really inclining towards recognizing Kosovo, and the people really didn't like the idea. They voted Vucic into power. Now the same guy, which I was talking about, Boris Tadic, he's a nobody. He has his own small political party, but he's a nobody. He's never going to get any close to becoming the president again. Vucic understands this very well, and he's very careful about what he says about Kosovo. And he knows, even he has like, and you can see that, like what's going on. Like there are immense pressures coming from the West for Serbia to recognize Kosovo, and Vucic is resisting that because he knows the moment he does that, he will fall from power. And that is a certainty.
We saw there was I believe it was Trump pressuring Vucic, and he did do that to run the train between Belgrade and Pristina. That was pretty cringe. We are out of time, unfortunately. Our 2 hours are, together are past, Marcos. So if you will just give us your concluding remarks about tonight, about the insights we gathered from Serbia, and tell people where they can find you, where they can follow you and support your work.
Well, all in all, I think that Serbia is, the people themselves are, yeah, way more conservative, way more traditionalist leaning, masculine than the West is nowadays. And that's the unfortunate situation with the West. But we are getting as much as any country is with our liberal governments, slowly but surely eaten up by this system. And it is again a question of, for us, the nationalists, how do you solve this? And I've said this before, we have to do the long march through the institutions. And you could, you could fill a whole library with books about how to do that. There are whole analysis, but nobody tried that. Nobody started doing it. There are a few groups around Europe, namely, for example, this thing in Germany called Gegenuni, like the anti-university. It's literally the university for nationalists, where like you pay like some money for online lectures by proper professors, and you get like lectured on geopolitics, ideology, philosophy, and you get like schooled right-wingers. Same goes for France. There's this thing called the Iliad Institute and also Academia Cristiana. And these people are really doing a good job. And the thing is, nationalists have to go off social networks, first of all, because we live in an age where we despise the modern world, and the best manifestation of how foul and materialistic the world is, the modern world is nowadays, it's the internet. And it's not social networks. It's a paradox. You have virtual reality. It's not real. The word itself, it's also a big paradox. So get off social networks. That's a message for all nationalists. Start making social networks in real life. Internet is only a means for propaganda. And keep in mind, it's not owned by us. And they will, any platform they can, they will turn it against us. I think Telegram at some point in the future will also become a hostile territory for nationalists. So people have to tend to go out. I like memes, they're funny, but like people should stop making memes. People should stop spending so much time over philosophizing. Start doing things, firstly for themselves, to make themselves better people for the sake of their own people, for the sake of their own family. So what people need to do is build communities in real life and build their families. And that's how we will win. You know, maybe you can't turn over normies and liberals, but at least you can turn your kids to your side. And, you know, you make like one or two, three, five children, maybe. I wouldn't say one. Like we nowadays, we need more than two. You have like three, four normal young people interested, oriented towards tradition, knowledge, what we used to be. Adventurers and pioneers. That's what we need. That's what kind of people we need. So make communities, real life ones, proper social networks in the real sense of the word, not Facebook, not Meta, not Telegram. Get off of that. Hit the gym, read, and go to, you know, forests, hang out with your friends. That's the basic message, how we will win. Interact with our people, and
That is it. To find me or, well, my community, if you're in Serbia, you can stop by Club 451, which is our clubhouse where we regularly hang out, have, as I said, have lectures, we drink beer, have fun, talk. We also go camping sometimes. We do political actions, of course, and it is a proper community. That's what I was talking about. Zentropa, the same. And you can find us on Telegram, Zentropa SRB. It's all together in small and in small letters. And there you have Club 451, same on Telegram. And that's where you can follow our work. And I'm really happy that I was here tonight and had to let you call me. And it was a very interesting show.
I'm glad to you appeared, Marco. And it's amazing. It's amazing how much you can learn about a place which is... I can get in my car and be in Serbia in 30 minutes, but I know so little about the place. We should not be so distant, us white people. We should know about each other.
Exactly.
And with that, I guess this has been the Writer's Block. I want to thank everyone who tuned in live, and I want to thank everyone who is listening to the replay. We do this for you. We perform this song and dance. We do this show so you may become better nationalists, better activists for our cause. I want to thank everyone who commented in the chat for all of your questions, for all of your comments. I rely on the chat to keep the show lively. You're good people, you know. Yeah, you have some great ideas, and some of them, they make it into the show, even if you don't attach a super chat. I want to thank everyone who donated. Your donations, your support is what makes this operation, the broader countercurrents operation, possible. And finally, I want to thank our courageous and indomitable moderators, Reed Johnson, Gadius Maximus, and Bartleby, for keeping the chat safe and for keeping everyone abreast of all of the relevant information and links. And we have a last-minute donation from Slog for one ice cream over on DLive. And with that, I guess this has been the Writer's Block. Bye-bye, people, and take care.